Good morning. You must want God very badly and yourselves very badly to sit this way. Thank you. It's good to address some of you again and maybe some of you for the first time. Pray that I can make this subject helpful but also interesting, because it can be. It seems that anything that concerns ourselves, us, is always naturally and should be interesting, because that's the meeting place. And what we're going to try to talk about, as the theme they gave me all week, is looking sideways at things. Now, we all grew up, if you grew up in any of the churches, with a rather constant talk of reform, repentance, conversion. That was Christian language, although there's been a lot of pushback against it. And some of the pushback, I think, is legitimate, because the way we went about reform was usually, to use our metaphor here, a full frontal attack. We went straight after evil, our faults, our weaknesses, our whatever they were. And it usually doesn't work that way. You have to do it sideways. And that's what I'm going to try to explain. Now, God does it sideways for us, but Paul says in 2 Corinthians 11th chapter, he says, the angels of darkness disguise themselves as angels of light. You see, no one, Thomas Aquinas said, no one is intentionally going to do evil. Everybody has it disguised in their own mind as good. Hitler thought in his convoluted mind he was doing good for the Germans or for somebody. Everybody in their limited software, hardware, mind, has it figured out that this is the right thing, the good thing to do. So just because you say you've found the right thing, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's true. And so what we've got to say is, how do we see what we don't want to see? How do we keep the angels of darkness from disguising themselves as angels of light? Because they always do. Now, I'm going to use some more contemporary language, but I want to make very clear that I think Jesus was way ahead of his time. He really was, not that they would use this word, but a brilliant psychologist, that he understood how this human species works. In the Sermon on the Mount, 6th chapter of Matthew, he says, the lamp of the body is the eye. Right? That's good stuff. In other words, it's all about how you see. And you've got to clean the lens and learn how to see truthfully and correctly, especially yourself, which is the hardest to see. And he says, if that lamp is working well, how delightful will be your seeing. But if the lamp that you have, your eyes, the way you see, is darkness, what darkness that will be. So, That's exactly what Freud and Jung are saying in the 20th century, and they just use Greek words for it that have now become somewhat a part of our English language. In this same 6th chapter of Matthew, Jesus uses another word that now has become a very negative word in our vocabulary, hypocrite. But you've probably been told the Greek word simply means a play actor. It isn't of itself negative. It's an actor, someone who is taking on a role. Now, the psychologists applied to that the word persona. We're going to start with that. And you all have one. You don't have to use that word. You don't even have to know about it to have one. You do. It's your chosen self-image, the way you see yourself, which has some accuracy to it, I hope, I'm sure. But it also has some level of illusion and deceit. We just can't mirror ourselves perfectly. Because we have a chosen, preferred self-image that we want to communicate to everybody else, we want to look like this or that or whatever, up or down, it's operative, it's always operative. Here's what happens. Now, when you have a preferred self-image that you want others to relate to and you hold for yourself, you necessarily eliminate all contrary evidence. Anything that comes up that says, well, that isn't really true. You know, I'm a loving Christian. I hope we all have that, you know, or at least I'm loving. Now, in fact, when we do things almost constantly that aren't very loving, maybe, or not totally loving, or are really caring about other people, we prefer to split, not see it. Now, that which we don't see and prefer not to see is what Jesus is referring to when he talks about the eyes that see poorly, and what he's describing in its worst state as a play actor. In fact, it's interesting, the Greek word persona, you've probably been told this by your preachers, it's a Greek word meaning the stage mask that the Greeks spoke through to amplify their voices. They were like megaphones. So they chose that very word, very similar to Jesus, that we've got a preferred mask that we wear comfortably, and usually we've been wearing it for so many years, we believe our own PR. We believe our own self-image is true. And like I say, it is partially true, but it's partially not true at all. And that's what the real meaning of repentance is. Because to start seeing that stuff that you've chosen maybe for 20, 30, 40 years not to see is very painful. And to get that new pair of eyes is usually a series of humiliations, disappointments, relationships that didn't work out. It's the school. This is what teaches you everything. So because you can't see yourself directly, the only way these eyes, this lamp of the body that is the eye, can be cleaned largely is through other people's mirroring. That's probably why most people are rightly called to marriage, to a relationship, because you know, you who are married, you have a daily mirror right there showing you the truth. You do not yet know how to love. And that's always true, so don't be too shocked or surprised at it. Who of us knows perfectly how to love? So when you live in any close or committed relationship or an honest community, you have mirrors constantly revealing your real self to yourself. Now, because we've split and decided not to see a whole bunch of things, in my last two talks here, I call that dualistic thinking. That part that we don't see, it's like having a mole in the middle of your back, you know? You just can never see it unless your sex partner tells you it's there, you know, or you stand in front of a mirror and still it's rather difficult to see. That is called our shadow self. You know, you don't have to like that word, but it very much fits in with Jesus' teaching. And here's what I want you to listen most closely to. Your shadow self is not your evil self. It's not inherently bad. In fact, I would say it's people who honestly struggle with their dark side, as we now call it, with their own woundedness, their own brokenness, their own inability to be totally truthful, totally loving, totally good. That's what creates the human persona, personality in the good sense. That it's struggling with the shadow. We call it shadow boxing or shadow work. That's what I would mean by looking at yourself sideways. You can never see it directly. It is always mirrored back to you, usually by painful relationships. That, you know, you didn't intend to say it this way, you didn't think he or she was going to take it this way, and then they come back, and we've all been through it, those painful conversations. You really hurt me the other day when you said this, or you didn't say that, or you didn't notice this. Those are the mirrors. And brothers and sisters, I know that we almost all, the ego pushes back at that point. It says, no, it's not true, I didn't mean it, why are you taking offense, or whatever. But trust me, at least on this, at least 10% of what they said, usually more, is always true, right? And if we can have the spirit of repentance, to use the old-fashioned word, a little humility to get our ego out of the way, usually we can see that. Maybe not in the first 3 minutes when we're defending ourselves, but if we can detach, look at it sideways, directly, never criticize people directly, and never come right on or humiliate them in public. Wait till the right moment when you know you've earned the right to speak, first of all, that you've loved them enough, there's enough trust relationship there that you can say it, and then at the right appropriate time. Said, Bill, what you said the other day, I'm sure you didn't mean it this way, but it did really hurt me because, you know. So you're protecting his dignity, her dignity, whatever it might be. And usually then the person will not get so defensive. And the shadow, if there is some there, and there usually is, can show itself indirectly. So we only know ourselves through mirrors. You can't see it directly. It has to be mirrored back at you. Or sometimes, if you've developed honest self-observation, you can catch it out of the corner of your eye. You rushed by somebody, perhaps. You barely noticed them. And you get a few feet beyond and you recognize, you know, I just sort of wrote her off or didn't even greet her. You'll see it. But it usually is out of the corner of your eye, indirectly. Now, if you don't have that corner of the eye developed, you won't see it. So let me go back a little more about the shadow, because if you can get shadow boxing correct and understand what's going on there in real repentance, brothers and sisters, I'll tell you, you're never going to stop growing. You're going to be my age, and you'll still see the mystery unpackaging. Karl Rahner, the German Jesuit who had so much influence at our Second Vatican Council, he said, as we grow in honest knowledge of the self, what this receiver station is and how it receives and how it doesn't receive, and as we grow in love of God, he said, and he made a rather strong case for it, they both grow in parallel and simultaneous fashion. In other words, As you clean the mirror of the self and get to see how you see and how you don't see, you will simultaneously, naturally, see God with that same increased clarity. And honestly, when you fall in love with your deepest self is where you'll find the mercy, where you'll find God in God's most clearest gaze and God's most clear face. So the two journeys proceed together. And you don't want to separate them. That's non-incarnational, to call one psychology and one theology or spirituality. St. Teresa of Avila in the 16th century said she had her mansions. We went from mansion to mansion as we grew in the spiritual journey, in the castle, as she called it. And she said the very first mansion is self-knowledge. And self-knowledge comes about by struggling with your shadow. So the more persona you have, in other words, the more grand, wonderful self-image you have, the more persona you usually have. That's why it's dangerous to be a priest or a bishop or anything wonderful that might be looked up to. Well, maybe they're not looked up to so much anymore, but historically they were. And even things like social worker, mother, all these things that everybody sort of says, oh, that's a good person. What happens is you tend to fall in love with that image. And then you need to defend that image. And anything that doesn't verify that you're a good mother, or a good social worker, or a good bishop or priest, you just eliminate. So the more persona you have, the bigger your shadow will be. The more negative information you have to eliminate. And that's why, like people like my father, St. Francis, just wanted to stay as close to the bottom as possible, where they had nothing to prove, nothing to protect, nothing to live up to. When the people in Assisi started calling him a saint, he asked one of the brothers if he would join him in walking through downtown Assisi in his underwear. just so he could blow any self-image. Huh? And then when that didn't work, they came the next week again in their underwear, and they created a little seesaw right in the center of town and spent the whole morning on the seesaw. Now, we would call these holy fools. This is someone who is utterly unattached to what people think. When you go on the real journey, you know that you are not what people think you are. Nor are you are what you think you are. And conversion is getting back to the naked self. Before you thought you were this or that, who you are, as Paul says in Colossians, hidden with Christ in God. The naked self can always make love to the naked God. When you get the two truths together, love will always happen, mercy and forgiveness will always be felt. But most of us believe, of course, we are only lovable if we create a worthy self. And so religion tends, not meaning to, but it tends to be high-level training in splitting, high-level training in pretending. That's why Jesus used the word hypocrite so much. Huh? He said, you're play actors. We got to get back to who you really are. So when you can keep doing your shadow work, and as I say, it'll never stop, mirrors will keep coming your way, showing you a little area where you've been blind, where you could not see, where you carry wounds all the way from your childhood. We've usually developed very defensive postures because we don't want to get hurt again. And we don't want to get hurt again by the other gender maybe that hurt us first, or if you haven't healed your father wound, we say every man you meet tends to be a repetition of your dad till finally that comes out of the darkness into the light and you hand it over for healing. Otherwise, people just keep doing the same thing over and over and over and over again. And brothers and sisters, they don't know it. It's not that they're bad people. They're just split people. You understand? That's probably why Jesus can say with great freedom from the cross, Father, forgive them, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Carl Jung said it well. He said 95% of people live 95% of their lives unconscious. We're just on cruise control, and you move through life with the same responses. Now we have the neural biologists and doctors backing us up on this. They say that the neural grooves that you use every day for your trained responses, they get, you doctors could explain this better, they get myelinated, they get stronger. And the ones that you don't use basically die away by the time you're middle age. So in all honesty, sometimes people by the time they're my age, they have about 4 or 5 neural grooves left, you understand? And you know exactly what they're going to say. Their response is totally predictable. This is a giveaway that they haven't done shadow work. Because what shadow work does, if you prefer, you know, the word repentance, the work of conversion, is that it makes you much more subtle. Much more nuanced. You don't give black and white responses. That's why authentic people are so delightful to be around. They don't give trained neural groove, immediate knee-jerk reactions to everything. You have that sense of a fresh response, an original response. They're meeting you, not just, oh, another woman, you know? And they're all in the category of, I know what women are like. And at that point, your shadow will take over and all your undealt with issues with women will be laid on this woman. When you think about it, I'm surprised, honestly, that as many relationships work out as they do. Because our opportunities for sincerely misinterpreting one another, sincerely misunderstanding one another, sincerely hurting one another are immense. And it makes sense why Jesus said 70 times 7. He wasn't saying, this wasn't an exit clause in case it might happen once in a while. When he says 70 times 7, you can tell he's presuming it's going to be necessary every day. Good people, especially good people who do not know themselves, are going to consistently hurt one another and, ironically, hurt themselves. But they don't know it. And then they wonder why people don't like them, or people don't want to be around them, or people don't know how to relate to them, because maybe they feel manipulated, maybe they feel shamed, which is all the shadow knows how to do, to keep reality away, because it isn't used to receiving reality. It shames people, it lays guilt on people, it creates fear scenarios, or it becomes gruff and tough to keep people at a distance. What is impossible at that point is the vulnerability you'd see in Jesus or a holy person. Vulnera in Latin means wounded, A vulnerable person is a person who is rather undefended. They let the moment come at them. They don't need to protect this persona here. Francis said he wore patches on the outside of his robe because he wanted people to know on the outside what he was on the inside. Now that's Christian freedom. When you have no identity to live up to protect, I am who I am, who I am, who I am, who I am. And that's a lot of dying to meet that self. It's a lot of letting go of idealized self-images. But honestly, and I don't think I'm exaggerating, brothers and sisters, those are the kind of people every one of you in this room wants to be around. They're easy to connect with because they're not giving you a preferred self-image. They're giving you themselves. Unvarnished. And that always gives you plenty to grab onto, to connect with. That's what we want to be. That's what we want from one another. But our cultures, English or American, they don't train us. No one's going to teach us how to do that. You young ones especially have grown up. How many images do they say you see in a year? I don't know how many million it is, but of course, most of them are good-looking people, you know. You wish you'd see more of these good-looking people. You know, most of us are sort of ordinary-looking. But if you've grown up on advertisements, you'd think we're all Cindy Crawford and Tom Cruise, and of course, none of us are. But we live in relationship to these manicured, manufactured images. And of course, we always fall short. None of us are handsome enough, pretty enough, skinny enough, tall enough, short enough, whatever. And that is not serving us well. It's not making love possible. Community, as some of you know, I started the lay community back in 1971 in Cincinnati, Ohio, mostly with young people. I was 28 then, they were 18. Eventually became 1,000 of us. And we had a center house. We moved into a working-class neighborhood in Cincinnati. And at one point, I had them paint over the doorway 70 times 7. And I said, that's the only way this thing is going to last. Because at 18, 19, 20, these young people, they couldn't have a lot of real in-depth self-knowledge yet. You have to be operating out of persona at the beginning. The postman thought it was our address, 70 times 7. But I said, no, it was the only recipe that this thing would ever work. And it did work. There's still 40 people back there today who still would call themselves the New Jerusalem community. But I'll tell you, a lot left, too. And not at the early honeymoon stage, the early euphoria of the ecstasy of Christian community and love of Jesus and love of one another. But at that second stage, when all of us started being mirrors for one another, and when there were mirrors shining at you from every side, showing you your shadow self, I think a lot of people, understandably, were not ready. You do have to have a self to let go of the self. That's the great paradox. Now, Jesus tells us we've got to do that. He says, unless you lose yourself, you cannot find yourself. So the question you're naturally asking is, what's the self we got to lose? And what's the self we hope to find? Thomas Merton, I think, gave us the best language for that He was the American monk who died in 1968. He said, don't call it what we Christians usually did, based on a very unfortunate use of words by St. Paul, where he made the distinction between flesh and spirit. If you grew up as a Christian, you all heard that. I'm convinced, and I've even done a study on it now, that when Paul is using the word flesh, he is almost identically talking about what Freud is trying to point to when he speaks of ego, and what Merton calls the false self. It's not the bad self, just like the shadow. You've got to dance with it, struggle with it. Life is a dance between the manufactured identity, the created self, and who you are hidden with Christ in God. The burden, brothers and sisters, in being in a secular culture like we both live in, is that most people, even a lot of Christians, don't even know there is a true self. And all they try to do is decorate up the false self, make it the most, you know, fervent Catholic in Birmingham, you know. It's a false self Catholic, but it looks Catholic, see. So that's why I say anything that's pretty religious or spiritual or highly moral, be careful, because that's where the persona and the false self can most hide. So it's not your flesh that has to die. Don't go out frontally, because you know what? If you try to frontally attack directly your own sin, problems, evil, you know what you'll do? You'll use your own weapons that you've already developed, which will only deepen you in your same game. So that's why you can't convert yourself. You can't. You are converted. It is done unto you by the events, the situations, and the relationships of your life. And all you can really do is get out of the way and be humble enough and honest enough to say, what just happened, at least 10% of it is true. What can I learn from this? How can I change because of this, and so this relationship wound does not happen again? And I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but I'm going to ask you internally, how many people do you know are like that? In my experience, in building community with people who are Christian, it is a minority position. I would say 7 out of 10 people, their initial response is defensive, is denying of the shadow, denying of the 10%, re-solidifying the false self, and therefore never experiencing the true self. Now, you can't directly discover your true self either, who you are in God, who God is in you. Teresa of Avila said that is the heart of all spirituality, huh? When you find God in yourself and when you find yourself in God, when the two selves become one, that would be radical, non-dual thinking. I and the Father are one. And then he says, follow me in discovering the same thing. Your radical unity with God. But you can't do that with a dualistic mind. The dualistic mind will always have two contrary pieces of evidence, and it pits one against the other. And for most of us, what wins out is all of our faults, all of our weaknesses, all of our sin. It overrides our objective, metaphysical, ontological identity in God. It trumps it again and again, and we lose our divine daughterhood, our divine sonship, because we're overwhelmed by our weakness and by our inability to love. So only a non-dual mind can forgive, can accept yourself, can allow contraries to coexist. So here's what happened. When we lost the contemplative mind and no longer taught it in mainline Christianity, and all of us got PhDs in dualistic either or, all or nothing thinking, first of all, Jesus lost out. Because we know the early councils of the church said Jesus is totally human and totally divine at the same time. Normally, those do not mix, but what it means to be the Christ is he put them together. And he said, in me, they are one. Now, if you look at the history of Christianity, what happened for all practical purposes is Jesus became only divine. Because the dualistic mind doesn't know how. That's paradox. That's contradiction. That's inconsistency. If you're too rational, you won't believe it. That's why, as I said the first day here, we created so many atheists. Because we gave them a dualistic mind, and then they couldn't process mystery. They couldn't deal with paradox. They couldn't deal with contradictions. The Trinity itself, which was our foundational image of the nature and shape of God, it's a mathematical conundrum. It's a logical impossibility. 1, 3, 3, 1, as the Irish nuns told us, don't think about it. Just believe it. Okay, sister, we'll believe it. No, but what happened, Karl Rahner also said this. He said, we could drop the doctrine of the Trinity tomorrow, and 98% of Protestant and Catholic lives would remain totally unchanged. Because it has not influenced this way we think at all, in a process way, that God is much more a verb than a noun. God is much more a flow than a substance. God is a living fire, a living flow, a living wind. All they could do is look for dynamic metaphors to try to describe the nature of a Trinitarian God. But the dualistic mind just shelves the whole thing. It's just a mathematical silliness. And so we put it over here. And we've lost much of the mystical life in Christianity, much of the appreciation of creation itself because of it. So, what happened? Jesus became only human. You and I, for all practical purposes, Jesus became only divine. I said it wrong. We, for all practical purposes, became only human, when the whole goal and meaning and purpose of the redemptive mystery is to put together in ourselves what Jesus put together, which is what it means to follow Christ, to do what he did. And he said, I'm doing it first to show you that matter and spirit can coexist, human and divine can coexist, that the physical world can be the hiding place of God and the revelation place of God. We just couldn't deal with that. And in fact, the part of ourself that we rejected the most, and you know this from our history, was our embodied self, our sexual self, our physical self. They say in America today, everybody's either obese or anorexic. Now, if there's any truth to that, I think it's a little exaggeration, but if there is some truth to it, it doesn't surprise me, because here we were, the Christian religion, the one group that believed Jesus, God became a human body. So you would have expected that if any religion would have had a very positive theology of body, a sense that this is okay, this is my receiver station, I got to trust it, I got to honor it, I got to make use of it, I got to listen to it and respect it, you would have thought we would have been the front of the line. But it's our Achilles heel. And in this, Protestantism did not reform Catholicism. It tends to have the same fearful, negative attitude toward embodiment. Why? Because our only tool was the dualistic mind, which splits between matter and spirit, human and divine, and always chooses one and rejects the other. So, the only reason I use this word non-dual so much, well, it's my last book, but it's because it's when we say the word contemplation, the contemplative mind, to see things calmly and openly and not to divide, to most people, when they hear the word contemplation, they think it means being pious or churchy or prayerful or high-level mysticism that only maybe some few hermits arrive at, when in fact, I think this is the pearl of great price, offered to all Christians by the indwelling Holy Spirit who lives within us and sees all things as they are, forgives all things as they are, accepts and embraces all things as they are. Now, before I stop, I'm going to add one little coda, because I know what some of you smart ones are thinking. And that's a good comeback. You're saying, well, if we just have this scary contemplative mind and we just let the field open, where do we do our prophetic work? Where do we recognize the evils that are overtaking our world, and how do we deal with them? In fact, the meaning of our center in Albuquerque that we founded 24 years ago was as a training place for people who are working for the poor, for social change. And my first 24 years on the road, I just, in your country and many other countries, just met so many social activists, so many people who were working for social change, who ended up being victims of their own partial enlightenment. In other words, I often met people who were ideological, dualistic thinkers on the left, angry people, alienated people, people who had poor social skills themselves, no patience with other people who didn't think like them, were still often violent in their forms of conversation, needed to defeat those who didn't agree with them. And finally, I said, this is not the revolution. If this leftist group gets in charge, it's going to be just as rigid in its own way as the people on the right who created their problems. And so we tried to establish a place that would teach activists a contemplative mind and send them back again into the border, perhaps today, which is so tragic, between our state and Mexico. Juarez is the border city that we live close to, is called the most dangerous city in the world, where literally, 50 to 100 people are killed every day in the last because of the drug wars. Now, our job is to raise up people who can care about that and who can insert themselves into that, but in a loving, peaceful, long-lasting way. As Jesus put it, we want to bear fruit, but fruit that will last, and not people who themselves, when it doesn't work, when most people don't agree with you, and most justice work, people don't agree with you, at least in our country. So you got to get used to failure, just like Jesus did. And there again, you can't get used to failure with a dualistic mind. You come back fighting against those who oppose you. You come back hating. You come back fearing, and you're split again yourself. So contemplation, non-dual thinking, to use a metaphor from physics, is the unified field. It's where God and humanity are one, where matter and spirit are one. Contemplation is a way to go there. It's so unified, it's so whole, that it doesn't need to eliminate the shadow. It doesn't need to not see my own limitations, my own failures, my own dark side. You realize after a while that these have been the situations that have made you grow. Before we send our men out on, we do these five-day male initiation rites, and before we send the men out, I tell them that success has nothing to teach you after the age of 30. You need a few successes when you're a young woman, a young man. Everybody has to have that to get started. But when you're my age, the only thing that teaches me anything, and I mean that sincerely, is shadow boxing. Facing the shadow side of myself, of the way I relate, the way I love and don't love. Facing the shadow side of the church that we talked about yesterday. Facing the shadow side of the United States. It's you know, when the rich young man comes running up to Jesus and says, "Good master," with great flattery, Jesus comes right back, "Stop all this. Don't call me good. God alone is good." And if God alone is good, that means that everything else in the universe is a mixture of darkness and light. And that in-between world where we live most of our lives is brilliantly called the shadow world. C.S. Lewis called them the shadow lands. This space where I have just enough light, just enough clarity, my lamp is good enough that I can see the darkness. And as John's gospel says, strong enough that the darkness does not overcome it. But you never, never totally get rid of the darkness. I wish I could give you more optimistic news, right? And the wonderful thing about Jesus is that he accepted such a world. He even let such a world kill him. And I've always seen, if you need a visual metaphor, I've always seen the two hands of Jesus as almost what it takes to hold the paradoxes, the two sides of everything. He was human and divine, right? He was spirit and he was matter. He was in a male body, yes, but he certainly was by no cultural definition a patriarch, a macho man. He had such a feminine soul. He hung between, symbolically, archetypally, the good thief and the bad thief. And St. Bonaventure, our Franciscan mystic, he said Jesus was crucified on the coincidence of opposites, that everything is, you know, countervalence movements between horizontal lines and vertical lines. And when you try to hold them together, brothers and sisters, you'll always be crucified in one way or another. In other words, not everybody's going to like you. That's all I'm saying. Because you won't be on the left or the right totally. You'll be able to critique not just both sides of yourself, but both sides of most political movements. And that's the third eye seeing that I think high-level religion was meant to create. When I wrote the book on non-dual thinking, that was going to be my title. I was calling it The Third Eye, Learning to See as the Mystics See. And they said, the editors came back and they said, oh no, Richard, if you call it The Third Eye, they'll all say, oh, Richard's Hindu now, or he's Buddhist. And I say, that's from Richard of St. Victor, the monastery of St. Victor in Paris, 11th century. That's a Christian word. But they said Christians don't know that. Remember the first time I taught in India, and you see the wonderful Indian women with that beautiful spot in the middle of their forehead, which in many cases is now a cosmetic decoration. But one guru told me, he said, you know, initially you only got that if you were enlightened. And he said it was supposed to show the third eye, that you went beyond the either or, all or nothing thinking, which is the way low-level people see everything and divide the world. And that's why they cannot deal with darkness. They cannot deal with their own darkness or anybody else's. They eliminate it. They exclude it. They torture it. They kill it, just as they did in the body of Jesus. And it's interesting, that became a cosmetic decoration in much of India, just like we Christians wear crosses, sort of as a piece of jewelry. But the real, brutal, clear, honest, transformative message is not always there. So I invite you to whatever God invites you to, and that is your life. You don't need high-level theology to get this at all. Just learn to receive the moments that come towards you as mirrors that reveal yourself to you. And they're always saying, by the way you receive them, much more about yourself than about the other person. We tend to say, she is, he is. But your reaction to them is all you can really deal with. We have a mile-long road in Albuquerque where our center is. We have two guest houses, and the Franciscan church is on the corner, and I live in a little hermitage way behind. And so I'm called the mailman because for some reason I love to get the mail every morning and drop off the mail from all of these, the Franciscans and my own and the Center for Action and Contemplation and our guests. And between these houses on this Five Points Road, as it is called, there's a very long stop light. And because there are five points that come together, and for all the directions to move. Now, Even though I teach contemplation, I have to confess to you, I'm a type A personality. I tend to be a workaholic. I tend to try to do as much as I can in any one day. So I'm running down in my little pickup truck to the corner, and I swear, God makes it turn red right when I get there. And I've timed it more than once. It's 3 full minutes. Now, 3 minutes is not really very long. You've lived many three-minute spans in your life. But one day I'm just, come on. Now, I didn't hear any audio voice from God, I promise you. But as clearly as I know how to hear God, I felt God saying to me, Richard, are you going to be any happier on the other side of Bridge Avenue? Bridge Avenue crosses Five Points Road. Are you going to be any happier on that side than you are on this side? And it struck me, no, I won't. If I'm not happy here, I'm not going to be happy there. So God said, you might as well get it right now. Everything you need is right here. That's a contemplative mind, where you stop resisting the red lights of your life. It is what it is, what it is, and God is right here in all of God's fullness and loving presence. And if you can meet the Holy One, if you can surrender to the Holy One, and it is always experienced as a surrendering, a letting go, a giving up of a little bit of what you want. And all I want is to get across the road 3 minutes earlier, as if it matters. But my ego gets so attached to that. Anything you attach to is basically ego, and you wrap yourself around it. So I've learned to be happy on this side of Bridge Avenue. And every day when I am home, they say after I die, they're going to put a little plaque there on that corner. This is the place where Richard Rohr was finally converted. I don't know that it's true, but I offer it to you because it's those kind of silly, superficial, ordinary daily events that teach you non-dual thinking, that teach you about you, and make you able to clean this mirror that you are, so you can mirror back the fully divine gaze. And that's the only goal. Thank you. Thank you.